ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Do you want to know who's really responsible for Donald Trump becoming president? It's Alan Funt. Yes. He's the man who invented reality TV, kind of by bugging people.
There was something kind of pervy and boundary crossing that isn't easy to sentimentalize.
I'm Mark Fennell, and that is just one exceptionally weird individual who changed the course of history, but trust me, there are more, and you'll hear about them. Just search for No One Saw It Coming on the ABC Listen app.
The news you read, the posts you scroll past, the political messages landing in your inbox, in your texts, it's not shaped by people anymore. Artificial intelligence is generating content faster than anyone can verify it, blurring the line between fact and fiction. Platforms and algorithms are quietly deciding what you see, shaping public opinion, and even influencing how government services operate. With deepfakes and AI-driven messaging shaping the rules of civic participation, can democracy keep up? This is your guide to technology and culture. My name is Ray Johnston, and welcome to Download the Show on ABC Radio National. Joining me to unpack all of this is Corey Alpert, a former Biden-Harris administration staffer and host of System Error, also a researcher at the University of Melbourne on this very topic. Welcome, Corey.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we also have Daniel Angus, Professor of Digital Communication and Director of QUT's Digital Media Research Centre. Welcome, Daniel.
Thanks so much.
Now, I want to start by asking, what does the collapse of trust in news mean for democracy? When AI can generate content faster than journalists can verify it.
Well, democracy requires a common base of information, and that's how we debate, that's how our political systems are set up, that we all understand a similar set of facts and we can debate how to interpret or how to move beyond those. And one big thing that these algorithms do is they fracture our information environment. We don't share the same stories, we don't share the same media sources. And then you go beyond that into the distribution of fake news and to the things that these algorithms do to distribute the things that elicit the biggest emotional reaction rather than the things that are most true or most helpful in that debate. So I think we can see this on two different axes here.
So whose problem is this to solve? Is this a tech industry problem? Is it a political problem?
I think it's a problem for all of us to contend with. But I'd say also, and back to that first question, that this is something that predates AI itself. We're really talking about here is an issue of institutional fragility and not just one of technological inevitability. So the case here is that news has been in decline for decades. We know this. And that this is a technology which has come into our lives at a period where we are, I guess, socially quite fragile. And so it really is kind of exposing some of those weaknesses in fairly profound ways.
And at what point does the volume of AI content itself become a threat to democratic decision making?
Well, I think like Daniel's saying, this obviously is a problem that well predates the technology, but this is something that the technology, that AI is doing more than any previous. We're now inundated with fake news but even beyond that, just constant amounts of content that our brains don't entirely know how to make sense of anymore. We no longer have a small amount of stories that we can deal with. We now have to deal with thousands or hundreds of stories at any given time and how to make sense of a world in that sort of glut of information, just from a psychological perspective, is quite challenging.
And if I can say, just on the back of that, that's absolutely it. And there's the real threat of crowding out right now, where you've just got this scale and acceleration of the ability to create content at scale that is a real issue, and that we need to attend to these issues around the attention economy. So what we're talking about here is that how is our attention able to be managed by the variety of digital platforms and services that we use every day. And how AI fits into that is another kind of, I guess, major lever in kind of pulling our attention in particular ways.
Sorry, there's something really interesting on that, because there's a study that came out just a few days ago about the problem of short form video. So your YouTube Shorts, Instagram Reels, TikTok, on that question of attention and how much these algorithms and these algorithmic powered platforms are doing to exacerbate this problem of attention and our ability, our inability now to hold attention for long enough to understand how important any of these stories are.
So how do we respond to all of this information, this misinformation, this disinformation that's being created? What tools do we have?
So, you know, there are huge questions of media literacy. You know, when we see especially a lot of these AI generated videos, a lot of it just is common sense that, to borrow an overly common phrase, is not all that common. And just being able to know that that's the kind of thing that might exist or might not. But I think we're, especially on this question of AI-generated misinformation, especially images and video, I think we're going to get to a point in the relatively near future where, in terms of video quality or even audio quality, it's going to be very similar to what was actually produced. So that will stop being as much of a tell. And we're really going to have to get back to this very fundamental human question that goes back thousands of years, because fake news is not new. We've had photos that are manipulated. We've had audio that's fake. We've had this for a long time, and we're going to have to go back to a very human level of just people being educated enough to understand that that is the kind of thing that public figure might have said. Otherwise, we're just going to live in entirely isolated informational bubbles, and that's a very dark prognosis for our democratic space.
It's about meaningful disclosure. So in our own work, we've been looking at advertising as one key example of this. And advertising is something which is very, very obscured in terms of how it works, how certain ads get into our feeds. And when we're working with participants, looking at the kinds of ads that they're exposed to, the thing that people need more than anything is a sense of meaning as to how those systems are working. And if they can kind of have that meaning making around why is it that this particular ad is coming into my feed, then they're able to do far more with that rather than just saying, oh, look, you know, here is a page and the code is there and there's this big complex flowchart. You know, welp, we've kind of achieved transparency. It's about how do we make it meaningful for people in their everyday context and lives.
Should micro-targeting be banned?
It depends. So, and micro-targeting is something which I think is misunderstood in the ways that it works. So take advertising, for example. I think people think that the ad system works by this idea of an advertiser going online and saying, all right, I want this ad to be seen by men between, you know, 35 and 44 years of age who are from this particular region of the country. That is not how this happens. What is happening now is logics of association. And so we are kind of, you know, reduced in our kind of online cells reduce these large vectors of numbers. And then that is used to compare us against other consumers within that environment and used for this kind of associative targeting and modeling. And so that demands a different kind of approach in terms of how you govern that associative capacity. And those associative capacities lend themselves into every aspect of recommendation pretty much online now. And so we need to think beyond this idea of like just micro-targeting to how do we govern the idea of how we, you know, this associative logic that is at play now in our media ecosystem.
Yeah, the thing on market micro-targeting for me is that the consequence of it is that suddenly we no longer live in a world in which I have the same information that my next door neighbor does. And so when we get there, that means that my neighbor and I can't have a reasonable debate. We may not even live in the same informational world. So like Daniel's saying, that is absolutely how that process works. One thing that I'm really concerned about is a world in which that ends up being combined with AI-generated content where all of a sudden it's not just 10 pieces of content that are shared with people in very specific ways, but individual content being delivered individually. And especially when we're talking about political information or campaigns, We may never be able to know what a campaign is saying to an individual person, and those messages may be so fractured that we're never able to have a public debate. So I think that's my sort of worst case scenario that I really worry about when we're going down this road of micro-targeting.
Southern Cross Austereo, the radio network, has been using AI newsreaders to both source, script, and read the news. Does a newsroom run partly by AI still serve the same democratic function as one run by humans?
I don't think so. So this is something that I work a lot on in my theoretical work, that one of the big differences with this introduction of AI into our media landscapes, and be that news or anything else, is now that we now have a piece of technology that's making a decision about what is important in society. Now, that's what's happening on social media. That's what's happening in sort of curated news feeds. And the thing that makes TV and radio and newspaper, that makes those unique, is that there are human decision makers who are saying, this is a story that's important. When I publish something in The Age or the Sydney Morning Herald, I work through an editor who then, based on their understanding of what's happening in Australia, what's happening in the world, the readers, they will then make an editorial judgment. And our brains are wired for that. Our social system is wired for that process, because if you don't like that, you can write to me or you can write to the editor who's made that decision. When we have an AI making those decisions, I think that really fundamentally disrupts how so much of our society works, when we no longer have a human who's verifiable, who you can push against, who you could protest, making that decision. Suddenly it's a machine in a room that doesn't have that same democratic lever of accountability, or to circle back a little bit, that doesn't have that same level of transparency that can say, this is why I made this decision. There are technological ways where it can explain a chain of thought, but that's not really the same thing as saying, I exist in the world and I think this story is important and here's why.
I'm going to offer you a very academic answer here, which is like, what do we even mean by AI? And so it's clear, like, even this, this conversation we're having, AI is probably involved in this in some way through a speech processing algorithm that's being used to clean up my audio and make that, more easily listenable by your listeners. And so it's even like how we understand what even is AI in this context. One of my good colleagues, TJ Thompson, who's at RMIT, has been doing a huge amount of work with journalists in newsrooms, understanding how they're using AI in their everyday work practices. And in many instances, TJ's research is showing that many of them are using them for a variety of functions. So much of this is actually to contend with the shrinking kind of workloads that they have. So you can use them for productivity, to be able to collect, different kinds of data or more data to inform their journalism in some ways. And so I think we need to be really careful about the ways in which we talk about AI within the context of news, because it's one thing to talk about an entirely kind of autonomously run newsroom where everything from the actual story, ideation, sourcing, and production, and then dissemination is run entirely autonomously through, versus something where there is a human still in the loop that's using and still applying editorial judgment, and that those editorial norms are still intact. Accountability is still preserved and disclosures are being made about that. These are two very different things. And I think we're already seeing that. We know that those AI tools are already in use, and it probably powered some very, very good journalism that wasn't perhaps available to us, say, 5 years ago.
So considering there's different types and different levels of AI that can be used in the journalistic field, at what point should audiences be told that content has been, partially or even in some cases fully AI generated? Do they have a right to know?
I think absolutely yes. So I think provenance is absolutely essential here, for trust and accountability, and to allow audiences and to trust that audiences are going to be mature enough to understand this. I think that, journalists sometimes underestimate the capacity of their audiences to really understand and what they're willing to kind of deal with. So that idea of protecting journalism, like the autonomy of journalism, by disclosing how these tools are being used is really important in that trust relationship between journalist and audience.
How do you feel about that, Corey?
I think that's right. I think just like seeing a video or an image, knowing that something is AI generated helps people better understand the information that they're receiving, and they can process that through their own filter, and they can give that the weight that they've decided it's earned. So yeah, I think that disclosure is incredibly important. And I think we're seeing a recognition of that on these social media sites that are beginning in very slow ways to acknowledge that. I think there is public concern about knowing, like Daniel said, the provenance of this information.
You are listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National. Ray Johnston here with you, and I'm joined by Corey Alpert, a former Biden-Harris administration staffer and host of System Error, also a researcher at the University of Melbourne, and Daniel Angus, Professor of Digital Communication and Director of QUT's Digital Media Research Centre. And let's talk about the concentration of power and platforms. How dangerous is it when democratic communication depends on firms whose incentives are not democratic?
Oh, this is, I think, aside from climate change, the most important political issue of our time.
Really?
Look, in many parts of the world, the internet, this entire beautiful, massive piece of communication technology that now runs our entire world, runs through a single company, Facebook. You know, this is not a small reason behind the massive proliferation of misinformation in Myanmar that ended up with a massive refugee crisis of a Rohingya minority. You have so many parts of the world, the only internet that's available, at least for free, on mobile phone plans is Facebook, which means that a single company run by a single CEO that's not democratically accountable to anyone, to any government, to any people, gets to decide the way in which people get their information. Mm. When President Trump was inaugurated in January, I had a piece in the Nine Papers that specifically looked at who was in the front row of his inauguration. There were 200 people in that room, and of those, something like a dozen were major tech CEOs. Yeah. These are the people who control 9 of the 11 largest companies in the world. And just think of the number of things that we touch in our daily lives that are controlled by decreasingly few numbers of companies that have massive profits. So there's limited competition. And we just saw some of this in a couple of cases in the United States where that competition is being negotiated and discussed, but where Facebook was essentially ruled to be competing with other platforms, even though I disagree with that. We have concentrated so much power, so much ability to decide what information is good and useful in our society in the hands of a small number of companies who, like you said, are motivated by profit, by expanding out their reach and their network. And profit is not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing that these are companies, but they have no competition. There is no local nuance. And the people making these decisions and these companies aren't subject to really any effective regulation.
Daniel, should democracies force platforms to treat political content differently?
Yes, I think so. And I think we need to be really careful here because, I mean, the idea of, exactly as Corey's been saying, the platforms themselves are incredibly powerful. And, you know, the platform capitalism writ large is in misalignment with, I think, the norms of democracy. And so, you know, the incentives that they have at the moment to shape and to kind of grow are shaped by, you know, the ideas of engagement and growth and attention, as I've been talking about, more than any kind of democratic norm or an idea of what a functioning and healthy society might look like.
Now, recently, Download the Show, we discussed the use of artificial intelligence in creating NDIS plans for people. When public systems are relying on AI, who becomes accountable when things go wrong?
Well, this is, I think, a massive question in the legal sense,
yeah,
of who is responsible and who is accountable for the outputs of any of these things. We've seen lawyers be disbarred when it turns out that they were using an LLM to generate legal briefs that had fake citations. And I think the implication there is that people are responsible for however they're presenting this information. But a lot of creative fields are having discussions about who is responsible control or who should be credited and who gets the legal rights to, let's say, a song that was produced by AI? Is it the company that produced the technology? Is it the individual who put in the prompt and engineered it in that way? Those questions, I don't think, are fully settled. Sort of at the more grim end of this, there was a case a couple of weeks ago where a robo-taxi, so something really powered by AI, killed a cat in San Francisco, and raising a lot of questions about how these machines are making decisions about life and death, about whose life is more important. And we're, I think, ultimately going to get to a point where there will be a legal case where we're going to have to decide if a company is liable, if an engineer is liable, if no one is liable when something like that happens to a human.
I think this is the question that the answer to is exactly why we need humanities in the room with us when we're talking about AI. Because at the heart of the question about, say, NDIS or any other government agency using AI as part of its decision-making process comes back to, well, what is the mission and what is the function of that government agency? And if the function and mission is to actually make people's lives better, to improve their conditions, to provide them with accessibility in society, then the use of AI could actually be incredibly positive in terms of coming up with creative ways in which we can actually make their lives better. But if you have a government agency led by a minister that is trying to cut corners and cut costs and to find efficiencies, then it becomes an entirely different proposition. And so I think we need to reassert the fundamentals of what is the actual mission and value set through which we are using AIs, whatever technologies we like, within that decision-making process. And then we get our answer. Is this, AI used to cut corners, or is it AI used to try and create creativity and other ways to actually improve human flourishing?
You are listening to Download the Show on ABC Radio National. Ray Johnston here with you, and I'm joined by Corey Alpert, who is a former Biden-Harris administration staffer and the host of System Error, also a researcher at the University of Melbourne. And I'm also joined by Daniel Angus, Professor of Digital Communication and Director of QUT's Digital Media Research Centre. And let's look towards the future. In the present, are democracies regulating AI fast enough? And if you could implement one regulation tomorrow, what would that be?
The short answer, at least for me, is no, they're not regulating AI nearly at all. Australia, I think, is taking some interesting examples of beginning to regulate some of these systems and beginning to put pieces in place to put public oversight over a lot of these companies and these models. But that's very early days. And I think we need a lot more of that. I think we need a lot more democratic experimentation. I did a tour through regional Australia over the last about 6 months, going into small towns and small communities where that was the main through line, that people wanted to feel like they had a sense of control over these technologies, or that at least someone in the public interest did. So I think we need to see more of that. We need to see more creative experimentation in lots of different places and lots of different contexts. If there's one regulation that I can make, and this might not earn me fans in Silicon Valley, but I think we need to really seriously rethink the way that we've treated social media companies as neutral arbiters, because right now they're not treated as being legally responsible for the content that is on their platforms. In the way that the ABC is legally responsible for the content of this podcast, if I post the exact same thing on social media, that social media platform is not responsible for it. I'm not saying we should go all the way in terms of, Twitter or X needs to be responsible for every single tweet, but we should really carefully think about how that looks and how that works in the modern world and who is responsible, because I think that changes a lot of how they distribute information, what information is distributed. And I think we should, again, carefully look at that and make some more modern decisions about how we assign that responsibility.
Do you think that AI ultimately weakens democratic systems, or is it just revealing cracks that were already there?
For me, AI amplifies whatever institutional conditions are already in existence. And so if we find cracks there, they were cracks that existed well before AI came onto the scene. And so I think there are strong democracies that can absorb and integrate AI pretty well, but there are others that are on a precipice right now and are likely going to be destabilized further by its introduction into that ecosystem. So this, you know, this is the US right now. It is an incredibly weak democracy in many ways. Rampant gerrymandering, you've got mass voter disenfranchisement, you've got a media ecosystem which is just incredibly polarized in a very destructive way. And so AI in that context is an incredible risk, given the fragility of it. Versus other, say, you know, Western democracies, which probably in those cases you might find there are risks there, but they're able to be kind of adapted or kind of countered through those existing governance arrangements.
I think that's entirely right. And I would also sort of go more to the psychological level that what we're finding as some of this new research about individual interactions with these algorithms and what impact that's having on people's decision making is that people interact with these algorithms in different ways. People have greater resilience against the worst parts of their opacity. Some people interpret algorithms as more opaque than others. And I think that there are solutions that are able to be found. And I think you can extrapolate that up to a system or country level, in that, like Daniel's saying, some places are just simply more resilient to this. And we have to find ways to educate more populations, to help people adapt to this new informational world. And this isn't the first time we've had to do this. You know, when radio was first popularized in the 1920s, people were terrified. It was the first time they were hearing a voice in their home that wasn't coming from a human being. The psychological impacts of seeing war on television were massive and led to a lot of the protest movements that happened in the 1960s because of the psychological impact of this new technology that was introducing something brand new and exciting, but also just, again, fundamentally new in their informational world. And I think we're seeing that again. I think we've absorbed massive shocks in our information landscape before. And I think humans are incredibly creative. And ultimately, I have some hope that we're going to find ways to adapt to these new technologies and to find a new world. And I hope that continues in a democratic direction.
I share some of Corey's optimism here, in that humans have huge capacity to create, to be creative with any new technology that's put in front of them. But I do think we are headed towards a moment with increased and greater concentration of communicative power in the hands of a very few, and an institutional dependency on those infrastructures. And so I think changing course requires our politicians and policymakers to really wake up to that and to do the hard work of investing in public interest infrastructures to kind of enforce those transparency and observability aspects and that contestability I was talking about, and make the platforms accountable. So do the work now, which is hard, to get those policy settings right. Because for me, the path forward here is socio-political. It's not technological. And so I resist frames where this is wholly sold as technology, and that the only people required are the engineers and computer scientists. I was a computer science PhD myself. They're lovely people, but we need the others, the humanities and social scientists in the room right now, because this is a political issue now and a social issue, not necessarily just a technological issue.
Unfortunately, that's all the time we have on this episode of Download This Show. Daniel Angus, thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find you?
They can find me online. I'm on Blue Sky, I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on a number of platforms, and you can find me on the QUT website as well. Thank you.
Perfect. And Corey Alpert, thank you so much. Where can people find you?
Thanks for having me. I'm on pretty much every social media platform as at Corey Alpert.
And if you've enjoyed listening to this episode of Download This Show, be sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review and a rating. Share it with a friend. I've been Ray Johnston, and you've been listening to Download This Show on ABC Radio National.
You've
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.